So this is Chance. He's we do the podcast there on Stash My Comics. We got Brian on the line.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going good.
We have been really excited about this. We've been talking about it for ever since I chatted with you on Twitter there, because both of us have been huge fans of the current Flash run, and we talked about it on the podcast quite a bit, and we're hoping to convert more of our listeners to this run, because it's really quite excellent.
I want to say thank you. I mean, I appreciate your guys' support. Francis and I are working real hard, to make the best book that we can. So, I mean, it's great to hear people responding to it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it comes across. I think your enthusiasm is palpable. I think you guys have been maybe chomping at the bit to do this for a while. Am I correct in assuming this?
I think Francis has been going or moving in that direction as a creative person, wanting to tell his own stories. So I think it's been a progression for him, from artist to writer artist. It's not as big a leap as people think it is, you know. For me, it's a little different because I've been writing for, 15 years. It's just nobody in comics knows it, you know.
Right.
So for me, it was more – I finally have the opportunity to write something where people can, see what I do, And for Francis, it was the opportunity, it wasn't just the opportunity, it was more of a culmination for him.
Right. So. Well, I suspected as much because the writing in here, I've found it quite sophisticated and slick. Can you tell us a little bit about how the writing duties are doled out between you and Frank and Francis? Do you just sit together for brainstorming sessions, or does one of you guys take care of the plot and the other kind of the script, or how does that work?
Well, there's no specific division of labor. He lives in Toronto. I live in Los Angeles. So we do spend an awful lot of time on Skype. And what we do is we talk about it. We talk it through together. I've said this a million times, and it's true, so I'll say it again. He and I don't actually disagree very often. And so for us, it's more about building on top. What if Captain Cold does this? Or, I see the reason why he does this is because of that. And then one of us will go, yeah. And then because of that, he can do this. So it's really organic, and it's really fluid in a way that that maybe defies the fact that it's two people doing it. We don't bring ego to the table. We don't say, this is mine, this is yours. We just want to tell the best story we can, And I think I feel like because of our personal friendship, we're able to sort of know what the other person will respond to and sort of like work that into our overall viewpoint. So there really isn't, we haven't had an impasse yet. So.
So getting more like into the story specifically, these four issues, I found everything really came together super nicely in issue four with the Manuel Lago origin, and so I was wanting to ask you, I've noticed in the new 52, several of the books have opted to start their first arc with kind of a brand new villain. Yes. And as far as I know, Manuel Lago, this is his first appearance. So
absolutely.
What was behind that decision to start this this new thing with a completely fresh foe for the Flash to tangle with, and how did you come up with this guy as opposed to someone else?
Well, I mean, I think there was sort of like a DC-wide, it wasn't like a directive like you must make a new villain, but I think, overall they wanted to have new and fresh things happen. So I think people were encouraged in most cases to create new villains starting out. In our case, it was suggested, hey, why don't you guys think about a new villain? So I think that freed us up in some ways because Francis and I already had an idea of where we wanted Barry to go and the arc that we're taking him through. As he, you know, we have a younger Barry. We have a Barry who is obviously single. He's, you know, he doesn't know as much about his powers and things as maybe, you know, the previous incarnation did. So we were taking a step back in terms of his evolution because obviously this is the root. So we knew where he was going and where we wanted to end up. So Francis and I decided, well, we need to do two things. We need to give him a villain who can challenge his powers because let's face it, Flash is really, really powerful. He, you know, I mean, I would argue that short of Superman, he's probably the most powerful fellow in the DCU.
Yeah,
he can do an awful lot.
Yeah, he's up there in the pantheon. So how does Mob Rule Mob Rule enter the picture as a solution for that for you guys?
Well, I mean, there's the practical side is challenging his powers is that as fast as Flash is, he cannot be everywhere at once. What happens when you meet a villain who literally can, because, you know, there's so many of them. So that was like the practical, okay, this is how we can challenge him. You know, Flash can't be everywhere at once, but Mob Rule can. So there was that side of it. And then the other side was my understanding of Barry Allen and Flash, he's never had, and I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself the biggest expert, you know. I mean, I did a lot of research and Francis, I think, had a greater understanding of the overall Flash lore than I did. But I don't recall him having a villain that was invested in Barry Allen emotionally that Barry Allen also had some stake in. I mean, with you know, Professor Zoom, Reverse Flash, like, you know, you have guys who hate Flash and you know, have a vendetta against him. But there was nobody that had a personal connection, at least as I saw it, to Barry Allen and the Flash. So we wanted to create somebody who could do a couple things, who could illuminate Barry's past and had ties to Barry. So that's kind of where he came from.
Right. So I think Chance actually, when you were talking about the research behind this, Chance had mentioned to me he was wondering about something specifically about that. Chance?
Oh, yeah. So a lot of what the Flash is, or what I've read, has a lot to do with, like, science because of his career. How much is involved in actually researching that aspect of it to make sure that it's all actually factual?
Yeah, not to mention like the Manuel Lago's origin, which is very steeped in some very advanced science.
Well, I mean, let's face it, we're telling science fiction, you know, as part of Flash's world. I mean, it is definitely, you know, has some science fiction. So all we do is we go from story and character first, and then we find ways to justify it with the science as best as we can. You know, Francis is not a scientist. I am not a scientist. I am not an expert in any of that stuff. But, you know, we can research, you know, like I think any writer can inform themselves enough so that they can write about something without sounding like, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. So, I mean, all we did with all these things was we found things that fit our story, and we found justifications that are based in at least real world science on some level. Just to give it, you know, so that it seems real, so that it doesn't ring false, you know. I'm sure if you put, you know, a scientist in front of us and he started asking us, barraging us with questions, you know, about extracellular matrix or, you know, regeneration, you know, he could clearly poke holes in what we're doing.
Right.
But that's not what the story is about. You know, to me, that's added value. You know, right. What I mean, if you see a word, you know, like extracellular matrix and you don't know what it means, you can look it up and you can learn more about that. You know what I mean? So it's just about building on top of the world and added value. You know, we don't pretend to be super brains that know it all at all.
Well, you could have fooled me because this arc is like it's believable. It's convincing me that this could really all could happen. You know, or just almost kind of thing. It's come across that way.
at least it's plausible, right?
Right, right. You mentioned briefly that this is a younger Barry. So you can confirm we are seeing some of the first adventures of Barry Allen in this arc?
Yeah, I mean, the universe, I guess, is 5 years old. I mean, that was sort of the directive we were given. And in some ways, it's a little difficult to negotiate because Justice League takes place 5 years ago, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's exactly 5 years ago, but, you know, it's in the past. And so, there are events from old continuity that have transpired. There's a timeline for Barry that it's a little bit fluid. It's not like written in stone, to be honest with you.
Right.
But we made a conscious decision to say, well, look, you know, for most people who would be, you know, using this as a jumping off point, let's show them a flash where he doesn't know everything and he's learning, you know, so we can learn with him. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that's just sort of how things work in storytelling, is that, you know, you can, if you had a guy who knew everything and did everything, you jump into the story and where do you go? You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think it just makes more sense to do it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm of the tendency to not get too lost in timelines and stuff. I did get the sense that this was a sort of a rediscovering of the beginning of the Flash, especially that he is not in an established relationship with Iris West.
Right.
And Patty Spivot is a new, brand new character from Francis, from the run with that you guys did with Jeff.
Actually, she isn't brand new. Oh. She had appeared previously. Jeff brought her back, I believe. But I think she hadn't been around in a while, you know. Okay. So she was somebody from the past.
Okay, okay. I wanted to touch on that bit of a love triangle going on.
Yes.
That I'm very much enjoying. I've read some of the reviews online, and a lot of people are touching on the strengths of the book, which are the plot and what you guys are doing with Barry's powers, and of course the artwork, which we'll get to that. But I was very impressed with the characterizations, which is done very subtly. Now I'm going to tell you my interpretations of what's going on in this love triangle.
Okay.
Maybe you can use it as you can tell me how dead wrong I am, or just kind of use that as a springboard to tell me more about it. But I'm getting the impression that Barry and Patty are sort of in a relationship of convenience because they work together, perhaps a little bit attracted to one another. But Patty, from what I can tell, thinks Barry's a bit of a weirdo, a bit of a dork. And Iris, what I thought was interesting, is new, seems to be fairly new at her career, and she's not the accomplished reporter that we've come to know. And she's kind of trying to go for the sensationalistic headlines. So I think there's a bit of a moral conflict between her and Barry so far. So I just thought it was interesting that without telling us which way this is going to go, we're assuming that eventually the Iris-Barry relationship will be restored. But if you are going to do that, and I don't expect you to tell me, you're keeping things ambiguous enough that I could expect either it could go either way. Am I just imagining all this?
No. You're in the ballpark. You're definitely in the ballpark. I think with regard to Patty and Barry, you know, the way I see Barry, the way Francis and I see him, I should say, he hasn't had a whole lot of time for that side of his world. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he's been Flash since he was pretty young, you know, and he's had all these other things that happen in his life. And so he's definitely not as developed with, you know, with that part of his life, like the relationship as someone might be who's 27, because he is committed to doing all these other things. You know what I mean? Like, he's giving so much of himself that he hasn't really quite discovered, you know, what to do with, with the romantic side of his life. So I think for Patty, I don't see it as convenience. I really don't. I feel like, most interpersonal relationships are based on convenience because, you know, it's people we see in our lives that we bond with, that we, you know, that we talk to. So to some degree, yes, there is a convenience level. But I think that's more to do with that they're kindred spirits in the science, in the CSI, in the geeky side of life, you know. So they have a lot of common grounding. And so I think that's why they have gravitated towards each other. And as far as Iris, there's not much history there. So, you know, who knows if there's enough to sustain some kind of, you know, spark. We haven't decided. You know, like we have a lot of stuff that's planned that we know where we're going, but we're kind of letting the relationship and the triangle sort of play out. So I can't tell you for sure that he's going to end up with one or the other.
This pleases me greatly. This is one of my favorite aspects of the book, and you just made my day there. I'm eating this up. Like I love that stuff. Chance, did you have a question?
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned earlier was about how Barry's still somewhat new at this. He doesn't know about all his powers. And one of the things I'm really enjoying is this mental speed force that he seems to have, or that he does have, that you guys are bringing forward. And I was curious about how evolved is that currently? Because he did just learn about it, and yet seems like he knows how to use it already. Is this something that we're going to see develop further and even stronger in him?
Well, what I find interesting just from sitting back and watching people's reaction to it is when we introduced the concept initiative, people thought it was really cool, but there was a segment of the Flash population that said, oh, you make him too powerful, now he's a god. And, you know, like there was people who were worried that we had opened up a can of worms. And then issue 3 hit.
Right.
And I think people were like, oh, okay, wait a second. These guys aren't just winging it. They have a plan. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you know, we have a theme, and I don't want to divulge what the theme is. I really would like people to sort of solve it for themselves of what the theme of the Flash is. And it's sort of over the first year, and we established pretty early on. But the thing with the powers is that it's not necessarily a great thing because. He can see it all, and he can you know, see everything, and you know, before it happens. It's almost precognitive, but it's what it really is it's deductive reasoning that he's using. But the problem is that opening those floodgates at the end of issue 3, he literally thought he had beaten the bad guys. That's why he got shot. He lost that attachment to the reality of his situation because it was such a phenomenal power that it almost transcends, you know, action.
I was really, really impressed by how you visually manifest those powers in the book. It's something I had never seen before. It's sort of a non-linear narrative technique where you kind of take snippets of different moments and sort of assemble them in different small panels on a page, overlaid over top of Barry. Now, how does one come up with something like that? That kind of design solution to
Because Francis is a genius storyteller. Right. I mean, we had barely gotten sort of the approval of getting the gig, so to speak, at WonderCon last year. And we were talking about it in the lobby of, I don't remember what hotel. And as he was going upstairs in the elevator, he realized, or it hit him how he won. We talked about the power and how it was going to work, but we didn't have a visual representation. Well, he went up and he figured it out in the elevator, and he came right back down and he's like, look, check this out. And he showed it to me on his iPad. He drew it on his iPad. It just occurred to him. And, you know, I mean, when you, sometimes, you know, artists just, they reach into the freaking heavens, you know what I mean? Like, you can't explain, right, you know, where they pull it from. Obviously, everyone has influences and is pulling from sources, but, like, I couldn't tell you, like, what was the thing that made him think that. But that was all him. That was all him, just like, I've got it. This is how we visually tell this story.
It's very clever. I was impressed. Another thing I was impressed with that touches on your game more specifically is the color scheme that you guys seem to have mapped out for depending on the sequence that we're seeing, especially when it comes to flashbacks.
Right. Well, we had a lot of storytelling to do, and a lot of it, you know, I mean, let's face it, a flashback is generally exposition, right? I mean, so you have to find creative and interesting ways to deliver exposition and also not get the reader lost, because, I mean, you know, I've read books where you can't tell when there's a shift, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Either because it may be a failing in the color, it may be a failure in the writing, you know, or even in the art, you know, but we just want to make sure that everyone knew, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, okay, this is a flashback. This is a piece of history, you know what I mean? And I think this stuff, I mean, visually, just like, I really like it. And there's very little color under there. I mean, like, most of that is just Francis's wash. You know what I mean? It's like, I think the first time that I did it, I think I just kept, like, reducing the color behind it until it almost went to white. So it was just enough to separate the things in the, you know, in the planes. And we just were real happy with the results, to be honest with you.
as so are we. Now I'm wondering, since both of you are artists, now you seem to have more experience in formal script writing, but since you're both artists, do you guys still write out a formal script, or do you script with thumbs, or how does that work?
Well, interestingly, I think we've done it all different ways with the different issues. A lot of it has to do with timing. You know, if I'm in the middle of coloring the issue after he's drawn it, and we have to do the next plot, then maybe we'll go, you know, faster to thumbnails layouts. But if he's drawing and I'm not, you know, I'm okay on the coloring side, then maybe, you know, this is where I've taken a bigger lead in writing it first before going to layouts.
Right.
As far as the dialogue, we generally, it's been like a hybrid. It's not Marvel. It's like somewhere between Marvel and DC style, where it's not full script and it's not just full plot. Like we plug in dialogue as necessary. So it's like this hybrid. And then we go from there to the layouts, and then we incorporate the layout. So what you get is like the script that has pictures of what the pages are going to look like, and it has enough of the dialogue so that our editorial understands the story completely. But then it gives us the opportunity to, once the art is done, to look at the art and say, okay, you know, how can we use dialogue to enhance and to, you know, to fill in some of the blanks. So we don't have like a finished script before the art gets done. We don't do it that way. For my, like say my creator owned book that I'm working on, Foster, I wrote the script. It was like panel breakdowns. It was completely a full script when I handed it off. So I mean, you know, I can do it either way. Francis can do it either way, but we have found like a happy medium.
Okay. Another question relating specifically to the story in issue 3. Iris does land somewhat of an interview with Captain Cold, and he says, I've got your next headline. This little blackout is nothing compared to the devastation I have in store for Central City. I've stepped up my game, so have my friends. Can you tell us who Captain Cold's friends are?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a big secret. I mean, it's you mean specifically like which rogues, is that what you're asking?
If you can tell us, I know that we've seen Trickster a little bit in here.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest with you, you're there's going to be a story where you see all of them together, but we're not introducing them together just yet.
Okay.
So what you're going to get is you're going to get to see some of the rogues, and you know, you'll see the top. You'll see you'll see Weather Wizard. You'll see like the classic rogues, and you may see some rogues that you never met before. But in terms of like when and where, I don't want to get into like details on that.
So you probably can't divulge if you're writing an arc of the formation of the rogues.
There's definitely a story we're working on that shows that.
Okay.
Where we're going to plug it in, I can't really say. I mean, like, I can't divulge sort of yet.
Yeah. Fair enough. I gotta ask.
No, that's fine. That's fine. And I'll throw one more for you. If all goes the way we have planned, and obviously when you're writing for a company, then they get to say yes or no. Mm-hmm. But you'll also be seeing Gorilla Grodd.
Oh, sweet! Oh, he's totally my favorite. Yeah.
And it's a slightly different take on Gorilla Grodd. I mean, he's still a gorilla. He still has telepathic powers. But I wish I could tell you more because we came up with some really, really cool stuff.
I wish the same. he's my favorite villain, hands down.
I gotta tell you, I have loved Planet of the Apes since I was a kid. So you know, I'm down with the Gorilla Grodd, and Francis just recently watched all the old ones. So like, we definitely have that on our consciousness.
Nice.
Yeah.
Let's see here. I'm just going through my list. Here's a question I sort of have to ask. Personally, I don't have any personal vested interest in this, but. As it's kind of relevant now, since you're writing the Flash and the, I don't know if we can call it the old 52 now, but the Flashpoint ended like this, whatever era, whatever it is you want to call it, of publishing, of DC history publishing, and started a new one, or ushered in a new one, and that was an event that came out of the Flash. So,
right.
Will we do? We have to expect that to come back into the Flash, like the Hooded Lady, Pandora? Are you going to address that, or are you going to let your story? We're just going to tell your story. How's that going to?
Well, you know, I mean, in the first issue, when at the end, when he quotes his mother saying, "Move forward," that. Metaphor was for the book. It was for fans. It was for DC 52, and it was for us as creators. So we have chosen to look forward and not look backward. Mm. So I'm sure at some point there will be more clarification, but I wouldn't go into it saying I'm going to find out by issue 12. You know. Where it all adds up or whatever. We're not really focusing on that. We are literally looking at the stories going forward and not really looking backwards.
Well, I support that approach, and I would venture a guess that most fans do as well. Hmm. Now I'm going through my list here. Oh, Chance, you had a question about, because Animal Man and Swamp Thing are obviously going to cross over. We've gotten a hint of Batman. There's going to be kind of a crossover thing. Are you guys going to try anything like that?
We've had talks about it. You won't see it in the next 4 issues. That's all I can tell you, really. You won't see any kind of crossover in the next 4 or 5 issues.
Okay, fair enough. Now this is a question. This is a tough one. If your son teamed up with the Flash, and fought you and the Rogues in a dark tag match, who would win?
Okay, so my son and the Flash.
Yep. And yeah, then versus sort of, you and the Rogues in a dark Flash. Tag match.
Flash. The Flash and my son would kill. Yeah, because he's just he's probably really good with dark tag. You can never hit him, so you know I don't even think the Rogues could hit him with a dart.
Mm.
You know, although the Rogues might cheat and then use their powers, but then you know you're going to a whole other area, and then it's not fair. You know what I mean? And then Flash and my son can call no fair.
Right.
Yeah, I think a straight game like on the up and up. Yeah, Flash wins that with my son.
Right.
Yeah.
I know you guys on Twitter there. You guys are pretty. How do you call avid dart tag enthusiasts?
Absolutely. I appreciate your research.
That's about it, Chance.
That's all I had as well.
Right on.
Awesome.
Anything that you wanted to add, or maybe a question I forgot to ask that you wish I would have asked?
I mean, really, anybody who is interested in me personally, like what I'm doing, I have a website, brianbuch.com. You can check out all things Brian Bucciolato on that website. Like I said, I'm working on a creator-owned a book called Foster, and it's a departure from comic, like superhero stuff.
Okay.
It's more horror, noir, ode to early 70s films.
Now, are you writing this, or are you writing and drawing, or?
I am. I created it. I'm writing it. I'm coloring it, and I'm publishing it myself.
Oh, really? Like so? No publisher. Are you just gonna?
Yeah, I've already printed. I printed out a 500 signed numbered copies.
Okay.
I did that in time for this last weekend was the Phoenix Con. And it's got a sketch cover on the back, and anybody who buys the book, it's you know, it's a higher price point because it's limited and numbered.
Mm-hmm.
It's $10 you can buy it on my website. As long as they last, I'm running out of them.
So is this like a 32-page comic? Is it a trade?
It's 23 pages of story.
Okay.
So, and there's a little bit of supplemental stuff. There's an interview I did with Comic Vine.
Right.
But one of the main selling points, I think, is that it's got a sketch cover on the back, and anybody who buys one, if you order from my website and you tell me what you want on the back, I'll do it before I ship it out to you. If you buy it from a store and you see me at a convention, at a store signing, at a Chili's, if I have my markers, I'll do a sketch on the back for free.
So, yeah, I'll get one of those for sure.
Yeah, so you can definitely order it from my website.
That's BrianBuch.com?
Absolutely. And there's also some stores that are carrying it. So there's also a list of the current stores that have it. So I'm just trying to get it out there. You know, I mean, I'm doing all this stuff myself, so it's probably not as I haven't hit a lot of markets, and it's a work in progress. It probably was not wise to try and do it myself. But
So this here would you consider it like a kind of like a pilot episode of a story you're pitching, or?
I mean, I'm committed to doing the first six issues, which is the first arc. I would love to do it as an ongoing. I mean, I don't know if it can sustain in terms of sustain itself by selling enough copies to, you know, for me to continue to do it. Mm-hmm. But I would love to, you know. And then probably the main reason why I didn't go to a publisher is that I wanted to maintain complete creative control.
Right.
Anytime you go with somebody else, there's a concession you have to make at some point. And, you know, people who work commercial art and commercial writing, you know, you always have to make concessions because you're getting paid. So that's one thing, you know, if you can't handle that, you shouldn't do it for a living. You know what I mean? So you accept that. So when I was presenting myself, I guess, the opportunity to write what I wanted to write, I just decided I don't want to answer to anybody. And I want to be judged by the choices I make. And if you like it, then I'm happy. And if you don't like it, it's okay because I gave you the version that I wanted to give you.
Right.
So
can you tell us a little bit about the story?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. absolutely. It takes place in what I'm calling Vintage City, which is like 1972, 1974 New York, San Francisco crime movies. So if you think like a French Connection or a Dirty Harry or The Exorcist even, it takes place in that kind of world where it's analog. There's no cell phones. There's no internet. And the aesthetic is of that time period. So that's the world. But the wrinkle to that world is there are these creatures called dwellers that live on the fringes of society. And they're like these primal creatures that, you know, some people might think they're werewolves. Some people might think they're, like Jekyll and Hyde type creatures. But they exist. And they basically like to do three things. They like to eat. They like to have sex. And they like to kill. And they don't get along with anybody. So they don't form societies. They just like living in the shadows. And they generally live in like, you know, economically disadvantaged places because they can do what they do and not be bothered. So our hero is Foster, who is a war veteran who has a haunted past, and he basically is drinking himself to death. His next door neighbor goes missing and leaves her 6-year-old boy unattended. He decides to take the child in, and it turns out these dwellers want to kill that child for a reason. So he has to dig deep within himself and become the hero that he doesn't look like he should be to protect this boy. And in doing so, he'll discover later on down the road that it's a redemptive tale for him. And there's a big twist at the end that I don't want to give up, but there's a very valid reason why they want Ben, who's the boy.
Cool. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out and probably write it up on the blog and everything. Yeah, sounds really interesting.
Well, so far people are liking it. You know, I mean, I've gotten, you know, 4 or 5 reviews. It was pick of the week on Comic Impact. Josh Fialkov talked it up on G4 TV. So, you know, people are really responding to it. So obviously that's satisfying. And I'm just trying to get it out there. You know, I'd love to be able to do this as a continuing series.
Yeah, well, I wish you luck with that.